name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فَلَمَّا قَضَى مُوسَى الْأَجَلَ وَسَارَ بِأَهْلِهِ آنَسَ مِنْ جَانِبِ الطُّورِ نَارًا قَالَ لِأَهْلِهِمْ كُثُوا إِنِّي آنَسْتُ نَارًا لَعَلِّي آتِيكُمْ مِنْهَا بِخَبَرٍ أَوْ جَذْوَةٍ مِّنَ النَّارِ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَصْطَلُونَ.
And when Moses had completed the term and was traveling with his family, he perceived from the direction of the mount a fire. He said to his family, "Stay here. Indeed, I have perceived a fire. Perhaps I will bring you from there some information or burning wood from the fire that you may warm yourselves."
So, in the previous verses, as you were with us, brothers and sisters, we were following the story of Prophet Moses, alayhi salam, as the verses of this chapter continued. We accompanied the verses of the Holy Quran. We were made aware of the difficult and tough situation of Prophet Moses in the very beginning, how he was born, how he was raised, and what kind of miraculous events and circumstances he actually experienced. But in all these efforts, in all these situations and hardships, Moses is still a simple Moses. He's a very noble, he's a very faithful man, he's very strong, and he's known by many people. Many companions of Moses actually recognize him as someone. They are seeing something promising in him, but he's not yet apostle. So, in the previous episode, we also mentioned that he agreed to be the son-in-law of Shu'aib. He agreed the terms of Prophet Shu'aib, and now he has a family. Now, this 29th verse says, فَلَمَّا قَضَى مُوسَى الْأَجَلَ وَسَارَ بِأَهْلِهِ آنَسَ مِنْ جَانِبِ الطُّورِ نَارًا. So, when Moses had fulfilled the term, he journeyed with his family, and he observed a fire in the direction of Mount Tur. So, as you can see, we have an interval of about a couple of years, maybe 8 to 10 years here, that the story, the verses of the Holy Quran do not mention anything specific during this period. Now, we see that Moses has lived a couple of years with his wife, he has a family, and now he's on a journey with the family. Now, when he observes a fire in the direction of Mount Tur, he says, قَالَ لِأَهْلِهِمْ كُثُوا إِنِّي آنَسْتُ نَارًا لَعَلِّي آتِيكُمْ مِنْهَا بِخَبَرٍ أَوْ جَذْوَةٍ مِنَ النَّارِ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَصْطَلُونَ. So he said to his family, "Tarry you here, because you have to stay. Verily, I observe a fire, and I shall bring you news of it, or a brand of the fire, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَصْطَلُونَ, so that you may warm yourselves with it." The Arabic term anastu, where Prophet Moses says anastu nara, anastu means to observe something in which there seems to be something intimate. This something has a kind of intimacy and peace in it. The word also jadwa means a peace. And the Quranic phrase, tastalun, la'allakum tastalun, is derived from salli, which means to be heated by fire. Now, Hazrat Musa addressed his wife with the plural form of Arabic pronoun in terms of kuthu, he said. He said, "You have to wait here," or atikum, or la'allakum, and it might be the reason that Moses is living with his wife and is maybe having a couple of children. Let's have a break and we'll be back.
الأجل وسار
So, brothers and sisters, now in this 29th verse of chapter Qasas, we see that Prophet Moses has lived for a couple of years with his wife. He probably has a family, a couple of children, and he is on a journey with the family. Now, he's somehow probably lost, maybe based on some traditions, or maybe not, but he sees a fire. أَنَسَ مِنْ جَانِبِ الطُّورِ نَارًا. So, فَقَالَ لِأَهْلِهِمْ كُثُوا إِنِّي أَنَسْتُ نَارًا. He said, you have to wait here because I observe a fire. لَعَلِّي آتِيكُم مِّنْهَا بِخَبَرٍ أَوْ جَذْوَةٍ. Maybe I bring you news of it or a brand of fire. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَصْطَلُونَ. So it is understood from the sentences, he has journeyed with his family, سَارَ مُوسَى الْأَجَلَ وَسَارَ بِأَهْلِهِ. And also, I shall bring you news of it, لَعَلِّي آتِيكُم مِّنْهَا بِخَبَرٍ. And also the sentence that says, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَصْطَلُونَ, so that you may find guidance at the fire, you may warm yourselves, that Moses is traveling by night. I mean, the context of the verse, the different kind of annotations that are mentioned in this verse, proves that it was a very cold and dark night during the time when Moses lost his way, actually. So, we reach the seventh scene of the story life of Prophet Moses. Now, nobody exactly knows how Moses spent that about 8 or 10 years, but certainly that term was among the best years of Moses' lifetime, because it was some wholesome, sweet, and peaceful years when he became prepared for a great mission. And this great mission is something that we will mention in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
SORB International Media Festival.
From playing the drums on stage to becoming a member of the European Parliament, our guest today is a man of integrity who chooses to be a voice of the oppressed rather than give in to the narrative of mainstream media. This is SORB, and I'm your host, Hassan Tavakoli.
Javier Cuozzo Permuy was a member of the European Parliament from July 15, 2014 to July 1, 2019 as an independent member. Cuozzo Permuy took seat in Parliament on behalf of Spain. He used to be a musician and has made a documentary film called A Fly in a Coca-Cola Bottle.
Javier Cuozzo Permuy, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much.
First of all, tell us more about the kind of work you do.
I've done different things in my life. I wanted to see where the life takes me to. I used to do anything to afford the cost of my education. Then I shifted to different tasks related to cinema and stuff like that. I also worked in the field of music and followed music along with other areas. I worked in a library as well. I had a CD shop, and then I worked in some TV projects. I worked at my brother's company too. After my brother was killed, my family and I began a fight against the US and their operations. Finally, I was introduced as an EU Parliament member. When the eighth term of the EU Parliament ended, I came back to the realm of media, and currently I am mostly engaged in this field. Mind you, the Spanish government stopped my activities in this field because I was involved in anti-imperialism and anti-war issues. This prohibition, however, opened new opportunities for me.
And what made you change fields from music to becoming a politician? I mean, what was the inspiration?
I was, in fact, a musician, but at the same time, I was a member of political and anti-racism groups. I was active in these fields. My first objection was against the NATO. In fact, we were seeking a referendum to be held. We collected around 200,000 votes against the NATO. Then I became a member of the syndicate and expanded my activities. Then most of my activities revolved around politics.
Did your musical background have an effect on your political success?
It helped me a lot because we were an underground music band and we used to exchange our works with bands from other countries. We did not have a manager and we would do all the stuff related to our music from A to Z. This helped us get to know the world and acquire new ideas. Many of our lyrics were related to anti-imperialist issues. I had to spend a lot of time outside home after I joined Parliament, but music has always been part of my life. I still play musical instruments, but as an amateur, not a professional. I just play them for pleasure.
In the time you did music, how much did you incorporate and involve and include political themes in your work?
Absolutely. Almost all of them were related. Spain's civil war against racism and also the world's problems, capitalism, which were known as Mundialista, and then globalization emerged.
Apparently, you also made a documentary called A Fly in a Coca-Cola Bottle. Interesting. First of all, why did you choose this name, Fly in a Coca-Cola Bottle?
This documentary was written by Pablo Iglesias, who's the leader of the Podemos. The documentary has been adapted from a book by Pascual Serrano. How can I say it's suitable for those who like great international stories? The documentary and the research show who prominent figures are. Pascual Serrano's book talks about such things. It says that you can talk about everything unless you say that there's a fly in a Coca-Cola can. It would have caused the Coca-Cola company to make losses and prevented its customers from buying its products. It would have generated this presumption that you want to hurt Western countries' interests and you are not allowed to use such phrases. The documentary drew positive reactions. It helped establish connections and served as a media tool. At the same time, the documentary was not boring to viewers. Moreover, in terms of its visual features, the documentary had high rhythm. We brought up an issue and it drew the attention of skilled journalists. It was interesting that how the documentary attracted their attention. This was also related to the activities of Spanish companies in Latin America. It showed how to defend indigenous people in Latin America who are abused by them. The documentary contains such features. We brought up the idea that how people can defend themselves. We talked about the idea that we need to be in favor of polyphony in the media. Our suggestion on behalf of Pablo Iglesias and Pascual Serrano was that one-third of any currency used for energy should be given to the people. Another one-third should be used for the interest of the people according to law. Most of the information coming in is released by private corporations and media. For example, Ms. Ursula von der Leyen prohibited the activity of Russian media, while the Constitution paid no attention to this issue at all. That was due to the issue of war and the special circumstances. But Ms. Ursula von der Leyen was not in a position to issue such order. Russian politicians vetoed this move and prohibited it. A similar thing has taken place at Hispan TV, and we need to see what the viewpoint of the Iranian government is in this regard.
Niños pequeños que hay que tutelar.
In your years of being a member of the European Parliament, tell us about the political atmosphere of the sessions there.
Working in the realm of media helps people dare to express the truth. But when you enter, you see that you have entered a different world. When I joined Parliament, there were 751 lawmakers. In Strasbourg, there were a lot of Parliament sessions, and I had to deliver speeches there. 50 representatives, by drawing lots, addressed the sessions. The European Parliament is like an airport terminal. There are 751 representatives in addition to other members who are constantly present there. When someone arrives there, they feel inferior. That's where some decisions have been made for wars, including the Ukraine war. I was surprised of the hatred Polish members of parliament had against Russians. The hatred was surprising to me. They used to mistreat and threat anyone like me who demanded respect for international law. The situation was really tough. I tried very hard, conducted research and studied to succeed in drawing the respect of the majority of parliament. Activities should be carried out in such an atmosphere, and they should be presented as samples for others. I don't know if I have fulfilled my duties properly or not, but there's hatred in a place that's strange and unfamiliar. Members of Parliament only read newspapers and repeated what their political parties told them. The European Parliament pays approximately 8,000 euros per month to its lawmakers, which is a lot of money. We used to give half of that amount to state parties. The EU Parliament also pays its members costs of their transportation and food. They also have around 6,000 euros as petty cash for hiring secretaries. We were under a lot of pressure at the time we worked there. That's because I myself formed a group with a number of parliament members so we could have dialogues with other groups. The EU Parliament had negotiations with terrorist groups instead of the official government of that country. At that time, I faced censorship but managed to take positive steps. Even members of some right-wing groups joined my group. Government support for terrorist groups is rejected, no matter the support is given by Brussels or Madrid. In general, it was a difficult environment.
When it comes to the issue of security, many say that NATO has played a negative role in providing security for the European region. Has NATO expansion been effective in providing security?
Muy negativa. Desde que era pequeño.
Since I was a child, I have never had a positive viewpoint on the NATO. My entire family accept my idea that a country like the US deploys forces here under the guise of providing security for the people. Realistically, NATO has some policies and guidelines for controlling Eastern Europe. Those policies and guidelines have been specified and adopted based on the US will. The first NATO chief once said that the North Atlantic Military Alliance facilitates the presence of Americans in Europe, makes Germans under control, and kicks Russians out of the equations. Germany is a country that has been conquered by Americans. All of the nuclear facilities in the Netherlands, Belgium, and especially Germany are controlled by the US. When the Soviet Union collapsed, there was this theory that NATO has emerged to defend Europe in the face of the Soviet Union. But after the fall of the Soviet Union, there were some negotiations with Russia. In the negotiations, they promised that NATO won't expand towards Eastern Europe. But they acted in contrast to their promise. All other countries joined NATO except Belarus and Ukraine. NATO began some wars after the Second World War. One of them was an attack on Yugoslavia. They also sought velvet and color revolution. They wanted to increase the US power. Honestly speaking, NATO itself is an obstacle to peace. If you review, you will realize that the US has never wanted Europe to be an independent military power. It has always wanted Europe to be dependent on NATO. All of the munitions and equipment they have are not Europeans.
En el cual se compromete a no ampliar la OTAN hacia el este.
Mr. Kolso, you've become a staunch supporter of Palestine for some time now. How do you think this issue can be resolved?
Like always, culturally, there has always been a sense of affection in my family for this part of the world. It's interesting that even in the era of Spain's dictatorship, military personnel and the country's left wing were against Israel. Everything has changed now. Currently, the right is the ruling party and Islamophobia has increased. But formerly, the situation was different. In addition, we have a common history with Arab nations and states. We had a lot of interactions with them in the past, and because of that, we have a friendly attitude towards Arabs. My mother was born in 1944 at the time of Holocaust. The Nakba and all the pressure exerted against Palestinians shocked all of us. Like all Spanish people, we felt that they are grabbing and occupying another nation's land and are committing a genocide. and then I did research and studied on the subject, which helped me get to know the matter more. Currently, we are witnessing the genocidal war on Gaza. Israel doesn't allow any journalists to enter Gaza. But thanks to eyewitnesses and videos captured by mobile phones, the situation of Gaza is shown to the world. Israel doesn't let journalists enter Gaza because it doesn't want people around the world to see the truth. For example, they tried to ban Palestinian flags in France and Germany. This shows how tough the situation is. They have carried out similar measures repeatedly, but thank God the Spanish nation has always been against this war. However, the right-wing party in Spain managed to change some people's opinions.
Palestino está claro.
Stay tuned, we'll be back after this short break. Don't go away. There are several MEPs, member of European Parliament, that give their full-fledged support to Palestine. How much does their support for Palestine affect their career, their job?
There are many members in the European Parliament who support Palestine, but there are also many who brazenly defend Zionists and anything they do. They support the military operation Israel carries out in the Palestinian territories. Let me talk about an example. Spain's judiciary once was investigating Zionist crimes. The case was referred to our commission, and as a result, we were fined. In that case, there was a dual national Spanish-Palestinian person. When the person was on trial in a court, I couldn't look at their face. I still think that it amounted to a war crime. I couldn't go and ask them to let me talk to that person. You can't imagine what a campaign was launched afterwards and what criticism was leveled against this issue. There, one of the EU Parliament members who was from Portugal supported me. In general, the Zionist lobby and the US lobby are powerful in the EU Parliament.
Ya sabían la respuesta, evidentemente.
Mr. Coso, you come from Spain. What kind of a future do you see for Spain?
I love my country. This is a small country with great history. Of course, I'm not happy with the current situation. I don't like some periods of the country in ancient times, for instance, the time we attacked Latin America. All in all, we have a different culture and great people. We're a nation who loves life. But I don't envisage a bright future for it as long as European deals exist in the country. Unfortunately, the economy gets worse every day. Germany, as Europe's engine, wanted to force us to become an industrial country. Now, Spain has the population of 47 million people. The number of tourists visiting the country per year is nearly twice its population, which is helpful for Spain's economy. We used to have the second highest life expectancy after Japan. Working on farmland has almost disappeared, and Spain is deteriorating in this regard. The European Union used to provide Spain with some aid to improve the situation. Then the increase in the construction of properties made the situation worse and led to real estate bubble in the housing market. There's no specific policy because the European Union doesn't permit. It's impossible for an employee with an average salary to buy a house. The situation is difficult. People should work hard, but in return they receive low wages. All of these things are blamed on the US. Washington continues its warmongering. Not only did Washington fail to help us, but also its policy may take our lives. Another negative thing is the presence of US and NATO bases in Europe.
And finally, what are your plans for the future? Would you like to continue in the world of politics or revive your musical past?
I don't think that I will come back to music again. I will remain in the realm of politics, even if I don't have serious activities or don't belong to a political party. but I will always analyze the situation. I have published a book about the time I was in the European Parliament. It's also about my different activities related to Latin America, Iran, Arabs, and Russia. I have been active in the media sector in these countries. I need to create an opportunity to help revive the genuine left again. We should fight for that genuine left that existed in the past. We should prevent the working sector and workers to get hurt anymore. There are many people who no longer vote. Statistics show that few people are willing to vote in Europe. There are even people who are after a project to create a united left that will once again revive principal ideas. The majority of such ideas, including supporting Palestine, have been put aside by this government, although it belongs to left-wing. That's because we have a cabinet that is in favor of providing Israel with weapons. It's interesting that Spain sells some weapons to Israel and at the same time buys some other types of munitions from the Tel Aviv regime. I try to continue my activities and provide enlightenment anywhere I can. In Spain, no one invites me anymore. Anyone who has opposing ideas face isolation.
A tu pueblo como tenemos derecho constitucionalmente.
At the end of every program, we usually request our guest to look into the camera opposite them and speak their mind to the audience, speak their mind to the world about an issue which is very important to them. So whenever you're ready, please look into your camera.
It was an honor for me to visit Iran and be in Tehran. I was here at the time of the presidential election. I saw what mainstream media in the West conceal. I saw the genuine spirit of the people and talked to them. What I realized through speaking with the people, including experts, provided me with a vision that was contrary to the image Western media portrays from Iran. I understood that peaceful coexistence is valuable as is mentioned in the UN Charter. This is genuinely being implemented here. There's no hatred between different people. I recommend my compatriots and Latin American people to visit Iran and not to pay attention to what Western media say about the country.
Thank you, Mr. Kosar.
Thank you very much.
And I'd like to thank our guest, Javier Kosar Permuy from Spain, for coming on the show today. Until another program, from me, Hassan Tavakoli, and the rest of the team here, it's bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iransat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The Doctors for America advocacy group has initiated a lawsuit challenging an executive order by President Donald Trump issued within hours of his second inauguration. And also a judge has told government agencies to restore web pages and data removed after Donald Trump's executive order. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge on Tuesday ordered government agencies to restore public access to health-related web pages and datasets that they removed to comply with an executive order by President Donald Trump. U.S. District Judge John Bates in Washington agreed to issue a temporary restraining order requested by the Doctors for America advocacy group. The judge instructed the government to restore access to several web pages and datasets that the group identified as missing from websites and to identify others that also were taken down without adequate notice or reasoned explanation. On 20th of January, his first day back in the White House, Donald Trump signed an executive order for agencies to use the term sex and not gender in federal policies and documents. In response, the Office of Personnel Management's acting director required agency heads to eliminate any programs that take down any websites that promote gender ideology. Doctors for America, represented by the Public Citizen Litigation Group, sued the Office of Personnel Management, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and the Department of Health and Human Services. The nonprofit group Doctors for America cited the executive order's adverse impact on two of its members. A Chicago clinic doctor who would have consulted CDC resources to address a recent chlamydia outbreak in the high school, and a Yale School medicine doctor who relies on CDC resources about contraceptives and sexually transmitted infections. The judge wrote, "These doctors' time and effort are valuable, scarce resources, and being forced to spend them elsewhere makes their jobs harder and their treatment of patients less effective." We continue with the Associated Press's coverage of this story. The case is among dozens of lawsuits challenging executive orders that Donald Trump, a Republican, issued within hours of his second inauguration. The scrubbed material includes reports on HIV prevention, a CDC webpage for providing clinicians with guidance on reproductive health care, and an FDA study on sex differences in the clinical evaluation of medical products. Removing important information from the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA webpages, is delaying patient care, hampering research, and hindering doctors' ability to communicate with patients, the plaintiff's attorneys argued in the court filing. They wrote, the agency's actions create a dangerous gap in the scientific data available to monitor and respond to disease outbreaks, halt or hamper key health research, and deprive physicians of resources that impact clinical practice. U.S. government lawyers argued that Doctors for America's claims fall well short of clearly showing irreparable harm to any plaintiffs and are unlikely to succeed in their merits. They wrote, either failure provides a sufficient basis for denying extraordinary relief. During a hearing on Monday, 10th of February, the judge asked plaintiff's attorney, Zachary Shelley, if the removal of the online material harms the American public. Zachary Shelley said the doctors' interests align with their patients. There is immense harm to the public, Shelley emphasized. There are massive threats to public health here. The judge concluded that the harm in this case ultimately trickles down to everyday Americans seeking doctors' care. The judge wrote, if those doctors cannot provide these individuals the care that they need and deserve within the scheduled and often limited time frame, there is a chance that some individuals will not receive medical treatment, including for severe life-threatening conditions. Doctors for America is a not-for-profit group representing more than 27,000 physicians and doctors and medical trainees. It was born from an earlier organization that pushed for health reform and supported Barack Obama, a Democrat, when he was running for president. The American newspaper Atlanta News First in Atlanta, Georgia, has also covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge on Tuesday ordered government agencies to restore public access to health-related web pages and data sets that they removed to comply with an executive order issued by President Donald Trump. U.S. District Judge John Bates in Washington agreed to issue a temporary restraining order requested by Doctors for America, which is a nonprofit advocacy group. The judge instructed the government to restore access to several web pages and data sets that the group identified as missing from websites and to identify others that were taken down without adequate notice or reasoned explanation. On 20th of January, when Donald Trump started his second term in office, he signed an executive order for agencies to use the term sex and not gender in federal policies and documents. In response, the Office of Personnel Management's acting director required government agency heads to eliminate any programs that take down any websites that promote gender ideology. Doctors for America, a nonprofit group, cited Donald Trump's executive order's adverse impact on two of its members, a doctor from Chicago, Illinois, and another doctor from the Yale School of Medicine, who relies on CDC resources about contraceptives and sexually transmitted infections. Doctors for America said these doctors' time and efforts are valuable and scarce resources, and they're being harmed by Donald Trump's executive order. The scrub material on the websites include reports on HIV prevention, a CDC webpage for providing clinicians with guidance on reproductive health care, and an FDA study on sex differences in the clinical evaluation of medical products.
what did they, what was the process like in terms of learning about when and if you were going to be deported? What happened Monday? And then we'll bring Asa and John in.
So Monday morning, first thing, I guess it was around 8 o'clock, just after I had refused breakfast, they came and they said, you have a meeting with your lawyer. And I just felt this wave of relief. And they took me, and Dina was there. And that was the first time she told me. She gave me a message from my dad, from my family, from Tamara, from everyone at EI. And she said, everyone in the world is talking about it. And I just, I was, there were tears of relief. I mean, when I think about it now, just that, all that feeling of like isolation just washed away in that moment. And then the official from the migration office came, and, you know, the plan had been on Friday, our hope had been that they would get me out of the country as soon as possible. Once that was their decision, you know, because they told me, you have a right to appeal, but appeal does not delay the implementation of the decision. So we are appealing, but the deportation was going to take place anyway. So at that point, you just want to get it done. You want to get out of there. At that point, they came, and I think by that point, they knew about what was happening in the world, and they knew how much attention this had gotten. They knew more than I did at that point, and that is so important. The solidarity, I think, really made a difference. That's a real lesson here. And then things moved pretty swiftly. There was a lot of paperwork to do, and I had to give them my ticket and my booking information. And it took them about half a day to organize the paperwork from 8 a.m. until around 2 in the afternoon. And then they took me to the airport in handcuffs, in this little cage in a police van, around, I don't know, 3-4 in the afternoon, something like that, probably around 4 in the afternoon, and in another holding cell at the airport until they took me to the plane. So, you know, at that point I was just, and they didn't give me my items back, and they didn't give them all to me. They couldn't, you know, they were not efficient as the Swiss are made up to be. I got many of my most important items back. Some are still there that will be forwarded at some point. And I was just so relieved when they gave me my phone back at the gate of the plane. I could call my family and I could call everyone. And that was the moment I started to see all the messages from people. Before then, I hadn't seen any of it, and it was incredible.
It was a whirlwind, and we were all very, as I said, very, very worried. But we also knew that, you had already prepared, accompaniment by a lawyer. You had done these things in advance, that should have made the process very streamlined. And yet, of course, the Swiss authorities wanted to put obstacles in every way. So let's bring on John and Asa I really wanted to talk about the lessons that activists, journalists, human rights defenders can learn from your ordeal and kind of where we go from here. And then we want to talk about what you missed while you were in prison, because it was an absolutely historic moment.
I mean, one thing I want to say, I missed most of it. One thing I will say, we had a TV in the cell. And Abu Bakr would be very proud of me because I watched a lot of football, which he knows I'm not an enormous fan of. But Mustafa, my cellmate, liked football. And I wasn't going to argue with him. He was very sweet, and it was the only thing that helped pass the time. And there was nothing else to watch, and you don't feel like watching anything at all. It's not like you're sitting there thinking it's Netflix night. You just have no spirit to do anything. But at one point, we caught a glimpse of a news channel, and it showed the Palestinian prisoners being released off the buses. And I just felt this surge of joy. And I thought, how wonderful. And then I thought, wait a minute, I'm in prison. It's just like I'm watching
so
this
surreal.
For prison. And I'd like to be released too. But honestly, it didn't dampen my joy. That joy I felt for them was spontaneous and enormous, and nothing could dampen that.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. Yeah.
I mean, we missed you because I wanted to know what you thought about this weekend. I mean, we've reported through a really horrific time, and this weekend seemed like we turned a corner in that, and just it was one thing after another. There was an amazing documentary that you have to get caught up from Al Jazeera Arabic about the resistance that was incredible. But then there was the prisoner exchange, and the prisoner exchange from the Gaza side was incredible to watch. I hope we can come up with better words, but I was awestruck by it. It was like hundreds, if not thousands, of fighters. They were perfectly organized. The captives themselves looked like they were obviously treated very well. The whole event went off. Just as the exact opposite of what Israel said that it was going to do, and that all of these 475 days of being told what Israel's objectives were to defeat the people of Gaza, Friday it looked like the exact opposite of that. The police were out in the streets, so the government was represented. Obviously, Qassam was represented. Saraya al-Quds was there. It was a perfectly organized event. Women and children were there celebrating, cheering on the fighters as they moved from wherever they were to the place where they handed them off. Everything was just done really tight and organized, and the exact opposite of what the Israelis tried to achieve. It was a real beginning of a weekend, I think, that really underscores a major defeat for Israel. So I wanted to know what you thought of that, and we missed you.
Well, I haven't caught up with everything, but what I've seen is incredible. And the march of people going home, those images, the images of people's joy and their steadfastness and their attachment to the land is something that, made us all proud wherever we were as Palestinians. It made us proud because that is the most true, most sincere, most steadfast expression of the attachment to the land and to the land itself. Even if there is nothing left, even if they destroy everything on it, people go back with the determination to live there, to rebuild, to be in their homes and their communities. And that was the best thing to come out and see. Honestly, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was truly amazing. When you think about what Israel's objectives in this war were, to return the captives through violence, that failed, to destroy Qassam, we saw them on Friday in perfect formation, totally organized, to destroy the government. The Gaza municipality is immediately out in the streets, cleaning, people painting. Just the scenes were unbelievable. And then the other Israeli objective was to make Gaza no longer a threat. And what you saw here in these pictures are people coming back, as you said, more steadfast, more resolute, more dignified and determined than they ever have been before, which was already through the roof. And so this is going to be an utter failure for Israel. And when you look at it on the other side, for the Palestinians, that Qassam's and Hamas, the national movement, all the factions were in agreement on the terms that were to end the aggression, and the aggression ended, that they were to withdraw from the corridors. And this week, it didn't look clear that that was going to happen. It looked like Israel was going to renege on that. As late as Sunday afternoon in North America, there was no return happening. People were stacking up at the border, at the Netzarim corridor. There was warning shots fired in the morning, and then real live ammunition shot into the crowd, and it looked like this was going to be a heinous massacre. And then within a few hours, we're seeing these pictures that just reversed all those horrific pictures we saw in November and December of people leaving with their belongings on donkey carts and just devastating pictures. So to just turn that all on its head, so the withdrawal from the corridor was also one of Hamas and Qassam and the national movement's demands. Return to the north, we watched that. In this one weekend alone, we saw examples of all four of Israel's objectives fail and all four of Hamas's and the national movement succeed after 480 days of just savage, brutal, cruel punishment. It was just unbelievable. We didn't, on top of worrying about you and trying to figure out what was going on, we didn't sleep. The Toronto Bureau didn't sleep a wink this weekend. It was just unbelievable to watch. And it was just, even from a guy from Toronto, I was totally moved. I just, everything that we've watched in horror from a distance, we watched this pure joy. And the moment that they opened the corridor, it was like a rock concert or something. It was just like everybody walking, people didn't even carry things. You could see people that had like makeshift rucksacks carried on their shoulders. They were like white vinyl bags. You could point those out in the crowd, and that just proved that everybody else wasn't carrying anything beyond the bag or the clothes on their backs. They were just going to return home. And on the other side in Gaza, people were painting the walls, as Tamara just showed that imagery, and like creatively doing it, because paint's super expensive, as you can imagine. So they have systems for stretching out the paint and mixing the colors so that you can get different colors out of the paints, and just cleaning everything up, cleaning the streets up so that when people come home, they would be welcomed, even though, the place, you would think, and we've been told that the place has been utterly erased. The first day, Palestinians are proving that it's not. And tonight, people are sleeping in their homes, some of them. Of course, most of the homes have been damaged or destroyed, but people are living in damaged, very damaged homes that have been cleaned up. And it just felt like such a moment. It's hard to say victory, but I don't know how else you could frame that. It was just remarkable to see. And I wish you were there to see the sights.
I know. I mean, Asim al-Nabi, who we just showed, the spokesperson of the Gaza municipality, as well as other contributors of ours, Abu Bakr Abed, of course, people were talking about how this is the first return of, the next phase of Palestinian liberation.
I could imagine that march. When I saw that, I imagined them continuing to so-called Kfar Azza and That's Kibbutz right. Beri and Sderot and all these colonial settlements built over the ruins of ethnically cleansed Palestinian villages. And I'm certain many Israelis had the same thought.
They were very upset at what they were
Ben
seeing.
Gavir, he was foaming at the mouth.
Crying on television, all that we had worked for, the soldiers said, gone in a flash. And Palestinians, you could watch them because you could. It was 7 a.m. was when it opened. Was when the Israelis were to leave. They announced it. and it was before 7 that people started moving, but you could watch them moving forward. And when they got to the first telephone pole, a Palestinian kid is climbing up the pole, planting a flag. Mm. As they walked forward, they got to the next pole. Someone climbed up, planted a Palestinian flag. It was amazing. People bringing back their family members in whatever way they can, on their shoulders, on broken wagons. It was amazing.
The Israelis failed to break the will of the Palestinians to actually return to their homes. And, you know,
they've strengthened it.
Yeah. And it's very similar. We're seeing very similar scenes as well, Ali, when you were on your little Swiss vacation from us. We saw very similar scenes in Lebanon, too.
That's right.
It's truly historic, and it shows that you can't beat the Palestinians, I guess. It shows that, Israel failed to break their will.
That's right. And they failed to break your will, too, you know, Ali. I mean, you know, there were so many statements and you know, statements of solidarity from people all over the world, you know, saying, like, they don't know Ali. They don't know, you know, they think that this is going to shut him up, that this is going to shut, you know, the electronic intifada up, that we're not going to talk about Palestine anymore, that we're not going to talk about these scenes of joy and of victory and of defiance and resilience, that we're just going to, you know, slink into the corner and be quiet. Like, they don't know Ali. They don't know us. We're showing some of these statements, people by like Craig Mochaibar and Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur, all of these statements from all of these organizations, the USPCN, of course, US Palestinian Community Network, the ADC, the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, was in touch with us, you know, several times over the weekend, and they put out a really strong statement pressuring the Swiss government. There's this this petition started by the Swiss Campaign for Human, I can't remember the exact Palestinian rights, Swiss Campaign for Palestinian Rights, that's now gotten, you know, 20,000, almost 20,000 signatures. You know, and Swiss Action for Human Rights, that's it. I mean, just, you know, so there was this, like, Dr. Jill Stein, of course, you know, people were watching, it was like we were watching two screens this whole weekend. One was, you know, everything related to Ali and worried about you and making sure that you know, you were okay. People, I mean, coming out of the woodwork, you know, people I haven't heard from in years, from all over the world, you know, asking if there was anything they could do to support. And, you know, and then on the other screen, we were watching these scenes from Gaza. And as John said, we were just hoping that you would be out, you know, and can like help analyze and discuss everything that had happened.
Well, let me say that tweet there, all those statements, but particularly that one from Hossam Shobat, you know, to have that statement from Hossam and from other journalistic colleagues, I got so many messages from colleagues in Gaza, that just leaves me in awe, because I've done nothing compared to what they have sacrificed and risked. And so I'm just